Hey folks, Derek here. I know it's been a while since this podcast was active, but I wanted to share an exciting new project that I've been working on recently with some friends called Two Player Theory. I really think if you enjoy Scholars of Play, you're really going to like Two Player Theory. Similar to Scholars of Play, Two Player Theory is going to include a lot of discussion, analysis, and of course, as the name implies, theorizing about games and media. But we're also planning some really fun experimental interview and topic-based series as well. I'm really excited about this new project and wanted to share the first episode here in the Scholars at Play feed. If you'd like to subscribe to the new podcast, check out the link in the description below. And without any further ado, please enjoy this first episode of Two Player Theory about Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. Hey everyone, my name is Derek Price.
And I'm Zachary Scalzo.
Welcome to a podcast. I'll end up cutting that out and we'll add something in it. But welcome to a discussion about the newest Zelda game, Tears of the Kingdom. New as in almost a year old at this point.
I know. Happy almost birthday, Tears of the Kingdom.
Yeah, actually kind of coming up on it. Maybe even, I didn't even look up when it actually was.
I want to say it was like May.
I feel like, was it that late? No, because I know I played it in like March or April.
Is that possible? Because May is around when I was getting all of my reviews from. So like IGN writes its write-up on May 11th, I think. So.
Oh, maybe it was that late. Oh, no, you're right. It was May. It was May because, this won't be on the podcast, but I was...
Maybe it will be. We don't know if this is good content.
You know, this could be great content. I got married last year and... I had a bachelor party, which I didn't expect to do. But I was like, you know what? I want to see my friends. I want to just like spend time with my friends. So I went to Nashville and invited some of my friends who I'd made from grad school. Kyle, some listeners of Scholars at Play will remember Kyle and some other. And Terrell was there as well. Some other folks too. But like one of the bachelor party activities we did was taking turns playing Tears of the Kingdom. That's kind of a core memory for me in playing this game.
Honestly, it kind of makes perfect sense as a bachelor party game. Like, it is a game that is about going and finding a bunch of friends and, like, solving things together, right? So, this is why we say we don't cut things out, because it might make good content,
Derek.
It might
make good content. God, you never know.
You really don't.
Zach, you love this game.
I think I'd go so far as to say I adore this game, Derek.
Okay. And I know, and so we talked about that. We've talked about this for honestly months now. We kind of played it together a little bit at the same time around when it came out. We were texting and talking about it. And then later we were like, we really just need to record something about this.
Yeah.
So I got to give you credit because you definitely gave me the kick I needed to be like, all right, yeah, I'll do it on microphone, I guess.
I'm a very good pusher, Derek.
I appreciate that. We just wanted to take some time and talk through, you know, our play experiences with this game. Thinking about the history of Zelda and like the kinds of Zelda games we've played and really sort of how they've shaped our experience with specifically Tears of the Kingdom. And then both of us have ended up having a lot of thoughts about the themes and the design and the things that Tears of the Kingdom made us think about at that interpretive and sort of narrative level, as well as at that sort of play level. So we're just going to kind of talk through some of those things. And I think to get us started, I just want to ask you, Zach, how did you play Tears of the Kingdom? Like, if you think about like your main experience, your default mode of playing that game, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, so what's really fascinating is one of the things, as I'm sure we'll talk about, that I found super engaging compared to a lot of previous entries in the franchise is that I really found the narrative very engaging in this game, which I know is a little bit of like, it's at least a half a hot take, it's a warm take. So I think that really what I did is I do feel like I approached it like the most RPG level that I could. I felt like I was putting myself as Link through a lot of it, which meant that when, for example, you jump off the Sky Islands at the beginning, make your way to Lookout Landing, and you're finally presented with a bunch of different options, right? You can go to the temples, you can go to the depths, you can, you know, do a bunch of collectibles. The thing I did first was actually all of the dragon tears. For one of two reasons,
What are the dragon tears?
So the dragon tears, and I guess this is where we're going to say this portion will be light spoilery.
Yeah, definitely.
But we will try to warn if there is like when we hit major spoily territory.
Yes.
So the dragon tears are essentially these things that there is a dragon in the sky who has cried, and these luminous tears have fallen to make these little ponds over the surface of Hyrule. There are 10 or 12-ish of them, I want to say. And what you do as Link is you go around, you find them, and you are given a cutscene that explains an element of the backstory, which I think, light spoiler at this point, is exceptionally Zelda-centric this time.
Mm-hmm.
So you find out where Zelda has gone, what she's been doing, and depending on the order you find them, you might find out kind of what's happened in the meantime, which I found an incredibly engaging take.
Mm.
So I think the primary focus for me was to really start filling in a lot of that story.
Mm.
And after that, exploring the things that I didn't know or that felt like they made sense from that story. So once the concept of the upheaval, which obviously is in that first cutscene, that's what brings you to the Sky Islands, and you move from that into the actual surface narrative of the game, I guess we could call it, I found myself going from like Dragon Tears to the depths, because I was like, this seems like it makes the next logical step here of like jumping down again. And partially because that also creates your map and like you want to know the world. Mm-hmm. And we've talked a little bit about open world games, and I'm sure we will continue to. But I think for me, following that narrative of the Dragon Tears across Hyrule also helped me get the literal and metaphorical lay of the land, which is, I think, one of the reasons I really love this game. It has that kind of thematic resonance while it also has the gameplay build into it.
So one thing I want to mention for people who may or may not have played Tears of the Kingdom is that I think one thing that makes this Zelda very, I think, unique, actually, is that it is basically, it is in large, to a large extent, it is the same map as the previous Zelda game, the first Zelda open world game, I think we could call it Breath of the Wild. So essentially, in many ways, you are sort of re-exploring a space that you've been to before. But as Zach alluded to, you sort of start in this, there's like two new layers on this world, and one of them is in the sky. But there's also this under, this I almost call it the Underdark. That is literally from Baldur's Gate 3. It's called the Depths.
Yeah.
It's called the Depths, which is just like, I think it's kind of one-to-one the same size as the sort of normal surface of Hyrule. But it's this dark area, literally dark. Like, there's no light down there. And you, much in the way that you reveal parts of your map in Breath of the Wild or in Tears of the Kingdom on the surface, you are like finding little light roots and slowly revealing the depths. I want to ask you more. So the narrative is sort of what pulls you in. Let me respond and say kind of where I went with it. So in terms of like, when I started this game, I am just a wanderer. Mm-hmm. When I play totally. these spaces, especially for particular reasons, I think, actually, in Breath of the Wild and in Tears of the Kingdom, I'm at my happiest when I'm just, like, zipping around, moving around the landscape and just saying, like, ooh, what's that over there? Ooh, what's that over there? And it's a very interesting experience because they definitely change enough about most places that it feels fairly distinct. You know, it is literally the same map, but there's all sorts of new things and pieces of this structures have fallen everywhere. And that, of course, there's materials for the whole new mechanic, which we haven't even talked about yet. But I still found myself very much drawn to the wandering aspect that I think, and I really think for me, that's the core of what made Breath of the Wild so exciting and interesting was just, right, they managed to hit that perfect little, they're almost like a physical distance of like interesting thing to interesting thing without making it seem too forced or too mechanical. It felt, There was a real sense of wonder in Breath of the Wild where you were just like, oh my gosh, what might be around the next corner or beyond the next mountain? There was really a sense of discovery in that one. I think that was kind of the core to me. Was there what worked well for you in this game in terms of the way it builds on Breath of the Wild but also does its own thing?
Well, this is something that I was thinking about when you were saying that Tears of the Kingdom gives us two new levels, because I think it gives us three. I think really the surface has been recontextualized in such an interesting way. And so much of the narrative is about returning to beginnings and like how we've changed. And we get a Hyrule that is, by best estimates, I'd say 8 to 10 years after Breath of the Wild. So I think one of the things that really resonates with me is the way that it's able to bring us back into this like world of wonder that is Breath of the Wild and the first like real open world Zelda game, but offer us a completely new way to interface with it, partially because you are a new person interfacing with it. Now Link is not an unknown entity. He is actually the hero of time. They know who he is. And he and Zelda have been on this quest together, trying to figure out what's going on with the gloom, which is the thing that has caused the upheaval. Mm-hmm. And there's something that is so resonant to me about being able to go back to what you've just saved and see it in ruins again, mm-hmm. that I think I responded to incredibly well. So in that way, I think the new Hyrule and the old Hyrule, the way those are thrown together, is really, really interesting to me. And then, of course, this happens also on the gameplay level with when you think the shift from the Sheikah Slate to these Zonai powers, right?
And this is where we should definitely talk about pretty much the biggest new mechanic, not only a gameplay mechanic, but also really kind of a theme for the game, which is just building and constructing things.
God, it's so good.
It's very good. So again, just to lay it out at the basics level, you quickly gain, you know, in Breath of the Wild, you had certain powers from the Sheikah Slate. Now you have the Pura Pad. and some of the Zonai, one of the Zonai, you know, several of the Zonai powers are about, like, attaching things to each other. And so this is important in two ways. You can take materials that are around the world, like big planks or wheels or stone, flat stone.
Big stones.
Big stone. You can take big stone and other big stone and stick them together. And basically, so you can build physical structures that Link can then climb, but then also the sort of twist on the weapon durability thing, which is very divisive for people. I never had a problem with it. I mean, it was just an interesting thing. But
I think there's also another power we're probably about to talk about that yes. kind of saves the durability.
Oh, okay. Yes, but, yeah. Totally. But you fuse. So you can take, and this is, I think this was like the magic, especially of the first 10 hours for me. It was like, you have all your old weapons, just a little bit like it was in the last game, although they're all sort of corrupted by the gloom in some way. So, like, their fallibility, their fragility is now, like, it's present. It's obvious. Like, yeah. These things are all corrupted and they're all broken. They're all going to break really quickly. But you can fuse, like, almost literally any object in the game to a weapon, and this not only increases its durability, but also often gives it, like, you know, you can build an axe with an axe kind of attachment thing and any kind of stick or sword even. You can build a hammer with like hammer looking materials and putting it on any sort of other, on a sword or on a, you know, branch or anything like that. So slapdash, squishing things together and like trying new combinations of things. In a way, it's very kind of a little bit Minecrafty, I think.
Yeah,
right?
Because totally.
You're just like combining things and crafting stuff to see like what's going to come out and how you'll be able to use it. So like that mechanic, I think, really sets it apart. And then like another aspect of this is just like not only are you putting brick, like piece of wood and piece of wood together, you're putting these simple, well, not super simple, like semi-simple machines together, like fans and this thing called a wing that looks like a little bird. It's like a tiny little paraglider plane kind of a thing. And you can turn it into basically like a little plane that you can pilot. You can make boats. It's really kind of quite expansive what you can mess around with trying to build. So I think that like that is not only like a really relevant mechanic, but like it wants to talk about creation and construction and design. Are we leaving out a power? Or is there something else that you feel like resonates in the powers of the mechanical level?
I mean, the other one, obviously for me, that hits thematically is rewind, right? Which is like returning things back to their prior states, or is a way for you to ascend to the Sky Islands without having to, you know, throw yourself in a lookout tower.
Yeah.
Is also a constant reminder that this game is always looking back to its previous iterations, whether that is Breath of the Wild or ancient Hyrule in terms of the narrative, right? There is something about I think in the same way of creation and exploration and wonder of building and experimentation, really, I'd say, is one of the big things that fusion and construction offer us. There is something about always reminding us that you can, in for 10, 20 seconds, turn back time. That's really resonant for me as well. And the fact that all of these powers are located in Link now, right? It's very easy for us to say there's a Sheikah Slate and there's a Pura-Pad, but the Pura-Pad actually isn't really any of the powers. It's your camera still, it's your map still, it's your inventory. But I think there's something really resonant about taking this thing that was relegated as these powers of technology and now putting them into the Hylian body, right? The human or humanoid body.
Definitely. So we talked a lot about the things that work well for us in this game. Zach, I happen to know that you completed this game in you know,
in
at least at one marker, you've completed it, right? So you've finished the story, you've beaten the final boss.
Yes, that's, I've got my fun little report card.
Please share Please share your report card.
That, first off, the Metacritic score is lower than Breath of the Wild, which is to be expected, but still kind of surprised me. Metacritic on this was 95 instead of Breath of the Wild's 97. But for me, I have logged about 200 hours into this game while also doing all of the other stuff I have to do as a living person and the things I want to do as a person who wants to live. And I've only complete 62.35% of this game.
It's truly massive.
It is insanely massive. It's... And there are just so many disparate things to do. I mean, I've heard a lot of talk about the Koroks and the number of Koroks in this game.
Oh my god, I didn't even think about how many there must be.
Yeah, and then the wells being the other.
Oh, yeah, that's
right. And then every cavern that you go into has a Blubble in it. There's so much going on, right?
Yeah.
Or a Bubble Frog, yeah.
I always said Booble in my head, which is funnier to me.
That is
bubble
funnier.
Bubble is,
I mean, it
probably
creates bubbles, which is what I think
that
I was going with.
That makes way more sense than Booble Gems, which is the currency you get if you shoot them. Anyway.
But yeah, that's my fun little report card section here, where I think I did, like, okay.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, so my grades are lower. I put, like, 120 hours into this game, and I have only finished, spoiler alert, I've only finished the five temples. I haven't actually gotten past that. I finished the fifth, you know, the spirit temple in the depths, got the mech.
Oh, God.
Holy
the
shit,
mech.
The mech. It's so cool. It also kind of sucks initially. And then I'm like, oh, wait, if you put cannons on it, it's fucking badass.
Yes.
So I was like whacking somebody with like a door. Like you can. So, okay, backing up. The mech, you get a fucking. Link gets to be on a mech. Effectively, you are the mech. And you get two. And so the fuse mechanic, where you've been fusing materials to swords and branches and anything. Oh, your basic weapons and stuff. Mm-hmm. Now you can just fuse items to this mech's arms. And then like one of the arms can be like a big spiked ball and the other one can be a cannon, which I basically never used any of the cannons until this point. So
okay, you have to put one on the end of a spear because you just get like a staff that you are shooting things
shit.
With.
Oh shit.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I never did that actually. I was also like, I tried a couple times and like blew myself up a couple times. And it's, I just ran
there's a learning curve.
There's definitely a learning curve.
But I think this also, and I swear we're going to get right back to what didn't work
please,
for you.
Please.
But one of the things that I think is one of the major themes for me too is collaboration. And I think part of what I really liked about Tears of the Kingdom is there were so many other people I knew playing it that when we discovered things, like my friend Bean told me, if you put a Hylian shroom on a sword, it starts springing your enemies away from you.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that.
And so many of these things I learned because other people were testing out everything and I was passing on things that I had tested and figuring out how that interactivity really works on my level in my own individual playthrough. And also as I would talk to you, as I would talk to my friends, my sister, etc.
Totally. I feel like we should talk about some of the themes that really stuck out for us, like the sort of narrative aspects, whether it arises from like the cutscenes or just like things that arise from our experience of gameplay or some of the side quests we did. What's the thing that resonated most for you, whether it's this like narrative level or thematic level? Like what drew your attention most?
Yeah, I mean, I think the big thing for me is really collaboration. I think that is what Tears of the Kingdom is about. It's about the responsibilities that we have to like our pasts, our presents, and our futures. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the major theme that I took away from the gameplay overall. I mean, a lot of Zelda games have this idea of Link as this individual hero who does have, you know, sidekicks or friends or sages or someone to help him. And I feel like in this one, we actually start to get a little more into the sages, and it feels more like a team to me, right? It's not like Definitely. Ocarina of Time, where you are essentially, the sages are your MacGuffins, right?
Yep.
When you're adult Link, you have to go and find the sages, and then they just kind of like chill until you go take on Ganon, and even then they just like unlock a door.
Right.
So I think in this game, between Link and the sages, Link and Zelda in the past organizing the original sages with Rauru and Sonya, it became a narrative that is about like building something together. It's about being a community and collaborating to build a better future.
Absolutely. I was rewatching the Tears sequence basically this morning. And like in many of those sequences, there's a couple of them where it repeats this. There's this scene between the Sage of Time,
Minoru?
Spirit Sage, Minoru?
Minoru.
Minoru, yeah. And Zelda are talking. Like, basically, Zelda comes to Minoru and says, hey, I'm stuck. I'm in your era, not mine. I want to go back to where I'm from, mm-hmm. right? She feels this, like, this responsibility to return to a time where she was. The time where your play of the game is carried out, essentially. She's shot back in time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Minoru is essentially saying, like, you know, the stones, they just amplify your power. You know, it's not going to, like, give you some new power that you don't already have sort of inside you. But there is this one way to sort of, you know, cross time in a way. And it's this like forbidden act of like, so these stones of power are these symbols, these things that grant you these time manipulation powers or light manipulation powers. And you can consume it and become sort of an immortal dragon. Literally, it's mm-hmm. Minoru calls it draconification. It's really, you become a dragon. You become immortal, but you lose yourself. And the game is really... wants to drive home how scary this like loss of self, loss of personhood, loss of individuality. How you will gain immortality, but you as a person will sort of cease to exist. And along the sort of like collaboration, like building things together, there's also the thing that resonates for me with this past, present, future theme, the theme of time, is like sacrificing yourself, sacrificing who you are for a very long distant vision, right? It's like it really is like a perfect metaphor of like what does it take to like change or save the world in some, even in some small way. This game is obviously, because it's a narrative game and it's a piece of media, it's like dramatizing that thing, yeah. right? It's like heightening that. I don't think we have to say like, oh, it believes in the hero theory. It's just, it's amping it up because that's the piece of art that it is. And I have more to say about that later. But it's like, you know, essentially the task of changing the world might necessitate losing oneself. And when you lose yourself, you are putting some hope, you're preserving some hope for the future, and you're casting it out really, you don't know actually how far out you're casting that hope. It could be, I mean, in the time of the game, it is literally centuries. It's 1,000 years or something like that. Yeah. I don't remember what, hundreds, 1,000. It's many, many, many generations. And that, for me, is super resonant for a million reasons right now, wherein our many compounding crises and the tasks that we have before us to, like, change the world that we live in right now. And we, you know, I constantly think about, like, what is necessary
in order for that to actually happen? How do we actually bring about change, even in a local context, that is going to be lasting and actually like change a system, one part of a system? And I've long wanted it to be something that you could do in a nicely paced way where you could like also live your life comfortably and maybe be happy at the same time. And I think that I'm not saying you can't be happy, but I think Tears of the Kingdom rightly warns you that you may have to sacrifice a lot of who you are in order for that to happen.
And I think the point you bring up about sacrificing individualism specifically is really driven home here, because it is in the act of sacrificing her individuality that she is able to like restore the Master Sword, which is the thing that is going to beat the Demon King.
Yeah.
Right? That's
a great point.
How we get an access to what she's done, right? All the dragon tears. She is the dragon, it turns out, that has been crying all of these tears. That is her past, right? I think that there is something so resonant about that. And in this way, I think this might be the first actual legend of Zelda. I don't think that Link is actually the hero here.
Yeah.
I think he's the player character. And I think like we track his journey. He is like the protagonist in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But I think the hero of this story is actually Zelda. She's the one who takes all of the actions that are necessary. She's the one who sets everything up for Link. She tells Rauru who he is so that his ghost can give him his arm.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And this actually links up with like another point that I had, that it's almost not even like at the level of a whole theme, but it's just a thing that I was reflecting on. You know, just like in Breath of the Wild, there are like four different sages in four different areas of the map, and you go there and you fix some problems in Breath of the Wild. In Tears of the Kingdom, you go to these four places and things are like fucked. Like things are really, really bad.
Oh, absolutely.
Like the weight of the themes in Tears of the Kingdom is like amped up 10 times versus what it is in Breath of the Wild.
Yeah.
In Tears of the Kingdom, it's like people are starving and the Rito are starving and dying of the cold, or close to dying of the cold, and their parents are all gone, essentially. Mm-hmm. You know, there's extreme weather, and you know, people have been forced underground. I mean, almost everyone has been forced underground in this game, if that's not where they are normally. There's like addiction, like serious, like community-wide addiction and substance abuse in the Korons. There's pollution and like a literal physical, like in the Zora domain, there's like all this like, I don't know, it's just, it's oil. Like
it's oil.
It's metaphorical goopy stuff, but it's just oil, and it's completely poisoned their water supply. And it's clogging up their gills and they can't like even move. There's all these people who just have to like sit in the springs and just try to recuperate, but they really can't, and it's like this really desperate situation. All of the situations are extremely desperate. Link is not a heroic character running around vanquishing evil guys, and that's what he's doing. What he's doing is unfucking stuff. He's like, he's only able to just sort of like remove the negative stuff in order to restore a former state that was probably good or at least okay, right? But he's not, this is definitely not a game where it's like, and this relates to your point, where I think this is a super good point. It's like Zelda's the one who, because of a sacrifice, because of a choice, sets up the possibility for more.
Yeah.
Link's role is mostly just to kind of, like, troubleshoot the worst possible shit and just get, like, knee and ankle and arm deep in the mud of life, of material need and deprivation, and try to, like, claw back some semblance of, like, life, material life for all these different people, and with all these other different people, until the real hope of, like, change can be... Like, Link is not the agent of change, really.
Right.
He's just the agent of trying to keep things going for a while.
And I think this also brings up a really good point, that what you're doing essentially in Tears of the Kingdom as Link is you are unfucking the world to allow the people who belong there to take over and like make the world what it was once again, right? Yeah. There's something really resonant to me about this idea of like Link also is the constant outsider, right? And that is because he is a hero. That is because he is seen as like, you know, in some ways, like not quite a consort to the queen, but, you know, he is her knight. You know, he is always this outside force that in many other games, you see, like, he gets this great, like, reverence for him after, and you get a bunch of appreciation in Tears of the Kingdom, but it's not like he is ever brought up to a level of, like, rule. Instead, what he does is he's, like, trying to make the world habitable for these people again so that these people can live.
Yeah. Yeah. And this, you know, this just reminds me again of, like, what is Link's role? What is the player's role? Mm. Not like we have this narrative resonant, like the issues people are facing are at this level of, like, mortal peril.
Mm-hmm.
And then Link, what the tool that Link is, you know, that you receive as the player in this game is the ability to kind of slapdash solutions together on the fly, which will last for a little while. And you can leverage slapdash solutions on top of each other in order to turn the tide slightly in a short time period. Right. So it's like this is where, like, actually the building, the tool, the mechanic of building things, of fusing stuff together, of using temporary weapons, essentially, sort of has another resonance of, like, you know, Link didn't, like, learn a craft or anything. He just, like, got a power and he's just kind of seeing what he can do with it. And he's like, he's got big problems to solve. And he's like, well, let's see what I can put together from what's around me to kind of fix this stuff. And like that, it's like once again, another very resonant sort of thing for our contemporary moment where it's like, we just kind of have to use whatever's around us because we can't be, like, waiting for the expertise to come. We can't be waiting for, like, the person who's mastered something to figure it out. We actually just, like, have really significant mortal danger all the time. And we need to, like, cobble something together.
Well, and I think in a little bit, we'll probably also be talking about how expertise and, like, trust in higher authorities is dealt with in this game, which feels very interesting to me.
Yeah.
But the other thing that what you were saying just made me think of is the temples this time are actually, you have to bring someone with you, right? There's something really resonant about the fact that actually it is not Link who, like, solves the temples.
Yeah.
Let's take the Fire Temple, our new best friend,
as
an example, right? You have to bring Yunobo down there.
Yeah.
First by breaking him free of this, like, mask of addiction, right? And then, in order to fight the boss, Marbled Goma, you have to use Yunobo's power. He is the one who actually can unfuck the temple.
Mm-hmm.
It is not
Link. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Actually, any dude with a sword could have gone with Yunobo, but you are the one who is the dude with the sword who's, like, brave enough to go. Which, of course, the, like, build here is that Link is the emblem of courage, right? He's not power. He's not wisdom.
Yeah.
That's what he brings. So I think it's really such a move towards purity of what he is.
Yeah.
That he isn't the traditional hero, right? He is just courage.
Yeah. Wow. I hadn't thought about that, but that's, like, spot on. And, like, you are powerful to an extent, but, like, you cannot do it on your own in Tears of the Kingdom.
Yeah.
They actually really hone in on that. Yeah. Oh, that's excellent point. I hadn't thought about it like that before. Okay. So jumping back. So we were talking a little bit about, we touched on the idea that, okay, this is a sequel. It's kind of built in the same space. The map is very similar, but changed enough to feel somewhat fresh. And I think we talked about that before as kind of like a refreshing, fun, new twist on an old classic. And it's like, ooh, this is great to explore. And I'm, like, finding new things in an old place that I once really liked. And that's true and real. But I think there's, like, there's definitely moments where you have this uncanny. There are uncanny moments, and there's a whole set of emotions and experiences that I had while playing the game that I think are echoed in some of the small narrative interactions where the thing that was familiar has changed into something that you can't trust anymore, or that's, like, estranged from you.
Totally.
And so, I mean, I think, you know, in you had the Yiga clan in Breath of the Wild. I feel like they're more common in Tears of the Kingdom, or maybe not. Maybe I just encountered them more or something like that. But I think the knowing, first of all, you sort of, when you come into Tears of the Kingdom, you've played and you've played Breath of the Wild, you're aware of, like, this trope where you could talk to a random traveler almost anywhere, and they might just be a Yiga clan member in disguise, and they might just, like, attack you right away. So that's like already in Breath of the Wild, carries on into Tears of the Kingdom. Makes you a little bit paranoid about talking to almost anyone that you speak to. But then there is this whole other level of, at the narrative level, you're going around Hyrule and you're exploring it and you keep talking to people and they say, oh yeah, we actually just saw Zelda and she was doing this thing that seemed bad. And like, it seems like, or she was just, she came by and told us to stop doing something that we, that sounds like a thing they should be doing. You know, like she blocks up a well that a stable needs. And it's like, oh, there were monsters back there is the thing you discover later. Mm-hmm. Or she is creating, I mean, she's doing all, she's up to no good.
She's become the CEO of BP and we assume that that's fine.
And we, it's probably go girl boss, I guess. but like, the game, I think the game for me has a sort of like paranoia about it. That like on the one side, it's like, oh, wow, I'm like coming home to a new place. And on the other hand, I think the designers kind of understood that people are going to have this also like sort of like estranging moments of like, oh, this isn't what I remember it being like. And also this, can I trust, like the thing, one thing that can be very disturbing is like to revisit a thing you thought was familiar and then it's different. And that can be very, that can like disrupt your sense of like, it can be uncomfortable in a way that like Breath of the Wild was all about just like, wow, I'm exploring and then it's wonder and it's joyful. And Tears of the Kingdom is like, you're not going to always have that feeling. And sometimes you'll have the opposite.
And sometimes you'll have the opposite in places that gave you such joy. Thinking about the Yiga clan specifically, the fact that they've taken over like Robbie's lookout tower.
Right. Yes. Yeah.
That is
totally,
like maybe one of like the biggest like places of joy is the lookout tower. That's where you like first meet Pura. It's where you like get a lot of like the first moments of joy, like teleportation is like facilitated there. Right. Yeah. There's so many really neat things.
Yeah.
And now it's become this place where a victim of kidnapping is being brought and you have to like fight two Yiga clan members. Yeah. Right. There's one just outside of the Temple of Time as well, which for me was a super, super high moment of Breath of the Wild.
Right.
Like, getting up like onto the plateau and like being able to like survey the entirety of Hyrule in some ways, you know?
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely something there in that they are much more present and much more active now.
And I didn't actually say this. I built up to this, but I should just mention, it's like what you discover later is that like the Zelda who seems to be everywhere causing trouble is actually a puppet of Ganondorf. Not only is it at that sort of raw mechanical like NPC interaction level, but it's, again, thematized at that big narrative level as well.
Which, if we're going to talk about the uncanny, that cutscene where the reveal of puppet Zelda is, where she, like, seems perfectly normal and then just immediately, like, deadens and falls as if, like, her strings have been let go, that's textbook uncanny.
It's spooky.
It was super spooky. Yeah.
The game has the depths, this big dark area where it's very dangerous. Again, there's more like horror a little bit. They play a little bit more in the space of horror in this game, which I kind of like. I think, I mean, I just kind of enjoy that at a certain level, but
it's also like, as just a little asterisk here, the only place you find weapons with high durability. So like, it's almost as if weaponry and like war have long lasting effects, it's going to create this like gloom like depth. Who would have thought?
There you go. There you go. Well, okay. So, speaking of the sages.
Yes.
There's an aspect of Zelda that has been long persisting. And I'm sure there's writing about this, about like race in Zelda. It's interesting, they try to get around it a little bit in this game, but when you think about the sages, there are like four, I guess there's like five sages technically, right? So you've got Rock Guy, and you've got Fish Man, who's a stunning, fun friend of yours.
It's true, you do call him Hot Fish Man.
Yeah. And then you've got the bird kid who's growing up, and then you have Woman. Which is just like,
whoa, you have Woman, but you have Gerudo Woman, which I think is actually super important for this game because it is the return of Ganondorf.
Yes. And this is like, so in the past, from my memory, and this is a little, I don't remember, I haven't played Ocarina of Time for a long time, but like the Gerudo was this like race of women. I don't know. The game really does invest in race as a real thing to a certain extent. And they usually just abstract it into animals, except for Gerudo. They are darker skinned and I think pretty much uniformly dark skinned in something like Ocarina of Time or the older games.
Yeah.
In this one, there's people with all sorts of skin tones who live at the Gerudo City now. That might have been the case in Breath of the Wild. I don't totally recall.
I don't recall for Breath of the Wild either,
unfortunately. In any case, there are cut scenes where you see a variety of skin tones of women. But again, they live in the desert. Mm-hmm. And again, like you said, Ganondorf is their king. And this is like a long-running thing in Zelda games. Is like,
yeah.
You know, Ganondorf was born in this desert, in this I don't know, society. Let's call it society of women, because that's what it is. Like, they're not a race of women.
Yeah.
It's just a society of women, and like every 100 years a man is born, and that's supposed to be the king. So there's again, it's like a lot of loaded stuff where it's like some of that is just like, well, it's all just meant to make him look kind of evil. But it's very weird. It's just a weird thing to have like women as one of the like race species alongside these other creatures that are very clearly like, now again, you have positive connections with these people, and they are, like you said before, I think they have agency and they're like active in a way that they actually haven't been for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, comparing it to Ocarina of Time, right? Yeah. The easiest parallel there, I think, is Noboru, right? Who's the sage that is Gerudo.
Yep.
And the thing you're trying to do is like save her from having been like mind controlled into becoming this like warrior creature in armor that you don't even know that she is. You're just fighting a mini boss, and then the mask falls off, and you're like, oh, it's her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right that there is like a very different level of agency. And like, we're probably gonna have to talk about Riju at one point, who has gone from being a girl to a woman. Like, she has matured between these two.
Yeah.
Because we remember Riju from Breath of the Wild. Right. She has now gotten older. Mm-hmm. And though she is still quite short statured, it appears like she has come to whatever maturity the Gerudo have.
Right. Yeah. So like this has existed for a long time. I found some like articles and like Reddit posts where people were like rightfully critiquing the way race is working in this game, and where it's like, and also like the way sex or gender kind of operates, right? Again, it's like, is it a society of strong women, or is it like this weird exoticizing, like, ooh, this woman zone where they're in the desert and they have dark skin? And then again, like, Ganondorf in this game is in the cutscenes, and his background as a Gerudo king is like really prominent. It's like, it's not like a secret. It's not like a thing that's just on the side. It's like kind of important. Basically, the cutscenes suggest that Ganondorf like opposes the rule of Hyrule. So we learn that Hyrule is essentially established by a Zonai. Is this race of creatures called Zonai? Rauru is a Zonai, or does he have Zonai technology?
They're called the Zonai.
I think the in any case, whatever their species is called, I'm going to call them species because that seems to make more sense. But you know, Ganondorf essentially opposes Rauru in this first kingdom of Hyrule. He fights him, and then he bends the knee. And Rauru's like, yeah, you're probably supposed to be a king, aren't you? Well, you're welcome to join my kingdom. I will extend my protection to you, right? And in some of that cutscene, Ganondorf himself sort of points out, like, Rauru is a Zonai. And I don't actually know that much about the Zonai, and I don't even know if we really learned their full history.
I don't think we really do. Like, in the beginning, we find out that they descended from the heavens and helped establish Hyrule. But, like, I really think, like, that's most of the extent we get from the Zonai.
I don't know anything more than that. But basically, like, Ganondorf is like, you came to Hyrule and you established this kingdom. And you appeared to us as a god with these machines and powers that no one else had. And in this scene, Ganondorf is like obviously being deceitful and speaking and being two-faced and saying, yes, of course I will respect your rule, and then leaves. And Zelda's like, oh, you know, there's evil in his heart. And Rauru insists that he understands that there's evil in this man's heart, but it's that this inherently evil kind of person. The critique that I think I want to make is a question about whose story has the dark-skinned king from the desert who lives here, who is not from outer space or from the heavens, who like has some sort of claim to some sort of rule, versus a sort of another species or race that comes down from heaven, seems as a god, and then marries and like takes a wife of the locals or something like that. There's a way that if you read this story as a colonizer's story, as an oppressor's story, there's all sorts of things that just don't make sense to me that all of a sudden make a ton of sense.
Yeah.
I want to sort of like talk a little bit about why does this matter? Why does this critique matter? It's like, there's a lot of critique about like, oh, this piece of media is fascist or this piece of media is racist or sexist. Those are good. Those can be good and important critiques.
Yeah.
What matters to me is the way that narratives that exist in popular fiction become the fabric out of which real political actors can lean on and draw from and nudge us towards the nudging, right? Mm-hmm. You can nudge us to think about things with the narrative forms that we have available to us that are close to us. And there's a real sense in which we have seen many fascist movements rely on a language of the forces of light triumphing over the forces of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that Tears of the Kingdom is like inherently fascist for this binary, but just that because it's the cultural material that's sitting around, it's something that fascists can try to use. And for me, an important question to ask when we're thinking about like the political meaning in this way of a piece of media is, could a fascist watch this movie and be like, hell yeah, fascist, I'm doing the right thing? Mm-hmm. Could a fascist play a certain game and be like, yeah, like this resonates for me. Like, yeah, there we are awaiting the return of a savior race or something. That's not about Zelda specifically. But like, you know, is there a way for like a fascist to imagine themselves to be the buddy team of all the sages and Link?
Mm.
I think, unfortunately, I just think there is. Like, if we flip things on its head and say, Raru is essentially... We have plenty of historical examples of this, of colonizers who move to a new, undiscovered space and then marry into that local place and then assume a place of power and set up a rule.
Mm-hmm.
Ganondorf become, in the colonizer's view, there has to be some sort of Ganondorf figure.
Yeah.
There has to be a Hamas. Mm-hmm. There has to be some force of evil that is pure evil, who tricks and deceives and can be hiding behind any person, and who has to be just deeply and inherently evil, not ever salvageable, right? All of the nuances of the real world where you have politics, economy, society, international politics, the between countries, between sovereigns, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
All of that stuff is outside of this narrative, and we just have like good versus evil. And if we turn our heads a little bit and see it from this way, that paranoia that I was feeling when I was playing the game of like, ooh, everyone seems to be not who they are. Zelda seems not to be who they are. All of a sudden, that in this view becomes the paranoia of the colonizer, of the oppressor, who is constantly feels like their empire is threatened. Mm. Who feels like every subject might be some sort of revolutionary or rebel, and we need to be very careful about how we monitor all of them and all of our interactions with them.
Mm.
And again, like we already talked about how like essentially the Zora are getting poisoned by oil, and oil is practically one of the most important products of sort of global empire, of capitalism, mm-hmm. and imperialism together, right? But in this narrative told by from the colonizer oppressor's perspective, it's actually some magical evil guy whose fault that there is oil poisoning the water. It is not like the sort of just ruler who has come here to be a benevolent ruler to these poor Hyruleans.
Mm.
Again, I'm doing some free interpretation here, but I just think that some of the weird dissonances that I felt throughout my playthrough almost just make more sense when you see it this way. Totally. I'm sorry. I know I'm talking a lot here, but like the other thing for me on this point is that just like that impossible amount of faith that almost every NPC that you encounter has in Zelda, it instead, if this story is told by a colonizer, by an oppressor, it's a lesson for the colonized.
Mm-hmm.
Though it may seem like we're harming you, you have to trust us completely. This is their view of how they see their subjects, right? Of their colonized subjects. Like, you need to just trust us. Everything's going to be okay. We need to be in charge of you, and our way is the right way. And then, like, and this is like the almost at that like species race thing. in one of those cutscenes, you see how Ganondorf sort of like gains power and then conjures up all of these moblins and bokoblins and all of the and the Hinox and all of the mobs that you're constantly killing throughout the game. The cutscene suggests that he like summons them from his will. Yeah. But when you play the game, they've now been there for thousands of years, presumably. Their bodies literally blend into their environments. They sleep and they dance and they have tools and they cook food. Like, the question of, like, what is a moblin or a bokoblin? Like, the game wants us to just be like, no, it's fine. Ganondorf created them and they're evil and they're inherently evil. They've literally been in this land now for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And they belong to it in a certain sense. And like, it's really, like, I know I had a few moments when I would be, like, flying over an encampment. They would be all sleeping, and I'd be like, you know what? They don't seem to be bothering anybody. You know, I also had plenty of times where I just killed them because I wanted some cool shit that they had. But, like, again, chasing this thought, it's just, like, another way in which, like, in order to justify killing these, like, creatures that are, like, maybe semi-sapient, we have to give it this magical, oh, they're actually secretly evil kind of thing. And this, you know, this could be taken in a vegetarian, vegan kind of critique, I think, or a speciesist critique. But, okay, I've spoken way too much. But I do think, this is my last phrase, what the game lacks is a people's history of Hyrule. Mm. What you don't see is, like, the people who are dealing with this shit, and they're like, what the fuck is going on? Like, what is Zelda up to? Like, I never saw a quest where someone was like, hey, Zelda is kind of fucking everything up, and, like, what the fuck? And, like, why is she doing this to us? Or, like, even questioning the or even raising the possibility that, like, maybe shit's kind of fucked up, and maybe the Hyrulean leadership is not taking care of us. I would love to see a people's history of Hyrule.
Well, I think there is actually a tiny gesture towards that, though. Okay. Because I think that in Kakariko, there's someone who's compiling essentially an oral history of the upheaval.
Oh. And
I can't remember the specifics of the side quest right now, but there is kind of like this question that he's like, but this doesn't make sense, so I need more pieces. And, like, once you get to the end of it, it is also clear that it doesn't entirely make sense.
Yeah.
So what I think this made me think of in a way that I have been trying to wrestle with myself, because obviously being so invested in how the sages are represented, I've also been thinking about this really complex representation of race. And also, like, at this point, we'll self-identify as, like, I'm a white person. So, like, my understanding of race is, like, probably the kind of understandings and experiences of race that the team might have been like, oh, this is the easy one. Like, I am encouraged to see myself in Link, who is also a white man.
Right.
You know? But the thing that I've really been kind of wrestling with is that both Rauru and Ganondorf are evil. And finally, in Tears of the Kingdom, we have, like, the return to, like, the problem is actually the human.
Mm.
You know, there's something about, like, becoming this human thing, whether it is a Gerudo or Zonai, who is, like, you know, hominid at least.
Yeah.
That's where this issue comes from. And I think it is related exactly to this question of, like, colonialism and imperialism, right? It is once we start getting something about these, like, human rulers that we actually can't entirely trust them. And although Rauru, I think, is pretty much unquestioned throughout the entirety of the narrative.
Yeah.
And I think that it's also a further complication of Rauru that I found myself feeling very strange about is, and I'm going to spoil a part of the ending for you. After the final battle is you are on top of Zelda the Light Dragon and you are fighting Ganondorf as, like, the demonic dragon.
Mm-hmm.
Once you destroy the demonic dragon, you are suspended, and the ghosts of Rauru and Sonya, so the first king and queen of Hyrule, Sonya, who has been killed by Ganondorf in the distant past, Rauru, who has been, his hand has been holding Ganondorf down through the entirety until the upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
There's this moment where the three of them, Link, Rauru, and Sonya, offer some kind of magic to convert Zelda back into a Hylian.
Mm.
And in the process, repair Link's arm, which, I mean, I think there's something also complicated about disability in this that would have to be unpacked.
Yeah.
And I think that there is something about imposing the human on the natural world that's really to be unpacked here.
Yeah.
The kind of like, but also slash yes and of this.
Yeah.
Is that I think the storyline of the sages is really compelling too.
Yeah.
Because it is that if we take a reading like the one that I am apparently favoring here and transparently favoring here, that Link is this kind of like paragon of courage. What he's done is he has like done the work of meeting this variety of people, this diversity of people on their own terms, letting them help unfuck their own things. And really, he's helping them unfuck the things. And it's not that they're helping him.
Yeah.
And there's something so beautiful to me about these, this confluence of all of these types of people to come together to help write a world more generally. There's something about having this like multiplicity of like, it's very complicated perception of race, including perhaps most notably for me, the race that our villain comes from, right? There is something that is so important to me in watching this and makes me wonder, I think you're right, it would be pretty unchallenging to play this as someone who is a fascist or proto-fascist. But I wonder if the complication of realizing, if it is brought to their attention, which I think it is pretty transparently in the game, that you are part of like a multiracial social justice team.
Definitely.
There's something that's so beautiful in that. And I think like this is also, you know, it's multiracial, but it's also like it goes from like the very young of Tulin to like the much older of Sidon, who like the Zora live for an extended period of time, right? It's like across race, it's across like classes in a lot of ways because they have very different forms of address. I mean, we have a literal prince in Sidon. We have a guy who was working construction in Yunobo. So there is something that is like really beautiful in bringing all of these people together to confront the evil, even if the way that The Legend of Zelda Tears of the Kingdom is articulating evil is also quite difficult for us to encounter.
Right, nailed it right on the head. And I think, I mean, hearing you talk about that and thinking more about the collaborate, like that, this like collaborative or like sort of collective effort that's like, I think you've convinced me. I don't think I had thought about it as that clearly about how much the solutions to things are inherently sort of non-individualistic. It just kind of attests to maybe this text is richer than I had considered, or like that the narrative here is doing a lot more work than I think that narrative plus like, again, the sort of enactment of doing things with these people gives you sort of a baseline experience of like, oh yeah, these, they also like literally help me, the player, to do things that I cannot actually, I'm not actually allowed by the game to do on my own.
Yeah.
In a game that gives you lots of shortcuts with the Zoni and fusing stuff. There's so many hacky, cheaty little things where you can like build a little scaffold and just totally skip some puzzle or fly something from some place to another. But when it comes to certain really crucial moments, you actually really need someone else to help you.
Yeah.
You can't do it on yourself.
I think it's also like, this is part of why I think for me, that big theme of like the responsibilities to like our pasts, presents, and futures is super important, because it also just occurred to me in articulating all this that I forgot that literally one of your sages is also a Zoni. Like Minoru is also like of this ancient race that is like trying to help you unfuck your world.
Yeah.
You know, there is something that is really beautiful about that. And I mean, even Link as this, I mean, I think the most superficial and like perhaps problematic reading of Link is that he is like a product of Hylian and Zoni like confluence in the same way that Zelda is, right? Because if Rauru and Sonya are the first king and queen of Hyrule, the presumption is that Hylian royal blood contains Zoni blood.
Yeah.
And Link, in getting the Zoni arm with all these powers that he is restoring, is also that kind of moment of meeting.
Yeah.
Which I think is really
interesting, resonant, and complicated. Yeah, exactly. Resonant. It's a lot. Yeah, there's a, I mean, all the themes come to get, keep coming back together in all these different examples.
And this is why, like, I get a little salty when I read online that people are like, oh, like, but the narrative felt like one of those standard Zelda narratives. And I'm like, I think it is actually doing a lot of work. It's just doing it also very subtly through gameplay reinforcement, which is kind of what a game should do. Like, not that there's a big, like, list of things, though I'm happy to make one, of things that a game should do.
Yeah.
But I feel like for me, the fact that like the gameplay so effortlessly and almost like imperceptibly nuances the narrative and like reinforces us and kind of guides our actions as much as it's guiding our thoughts is a really incredibly strong point to this game for me.
Totally. Thanks so much for having a conversation with me, Zach. This is super fun. We don't really have a website or a place where this is going to live yet. Or
but we're going to. It's going to be really exciting.
All that stuff's going to exist soon. So keep in touch for more. Also, just a note about like what this might look like. I mean, I think there's going to be a variety of formats for this. Some of them will be discussion-based like this. But I'm having some thoughts about doing almost more thematic, investigative, almost interview style, where I build a narrative out of a bunch of different interviews with people on like topics or games or something like that. And I think honestly, this podcast is going to include things, games, and it's also going to include other forms of media. So get excited. We're going places.
Stay excited.
Get excited. Stay excited.
It sounds like we have an outro.
That's a wrap.